When you find reality is yanked violently from straight ahead to the hard insane right, you know you're off the beaten path. Defenestrate Media and The Left Show present The Sidetrack with Jason Williams.
Welcome to The Sidetrack. I'm Jason Williams, and I didn't mean to take a week off last week. Jeff and crew at The Left Show had planned to, but I was going to have a brand new shiny episode of The Sidetrack to submit. When I sat down to record early last week, I had in mind this idea that I needed to not just repeat myself yet again. Several episodes into The Sidetrack's initial run here, and I've talked about nothing but impeachment, Donald Trump, the Mueller report, how awful Donald Trump is, the fact that we elected a rotten tangerine as president. It's just something sitting down in front of a microphone that wants to come out of my mouth. It's what's on my mind. But I wanted to do something new last week, so I forced a few things, and it just wasn't interesting to me. And if it's not interesting to me, I can't expect it to be interesting to anyone who might be listening to The Sidetrack. So it just folded every day last week up until the draconian cutoff and rules that Jeff imposes on all of us. I'm kidding. It's very flexible around here, but I had nothing. And it's not that there was nothing else interesting me. It's just that the only really big thing on my mind that had me wanting to say something or make me feel like I had to say something, to use what little platforms, what few platforms, I don't know what the grammar is on that, a small number of platforms that I have, I felt this desire to use them in that way every time I sat down to use them. And obviously, it's something I feel is very important, but I don't have anything else to say about it, and I recognize that. So I'm getting to something here, trust me. It's the issue is not going to be resolved soon, and I still don't have the faith that many of my admittedly equally, if not smarter, friends have in Utah House we're getting to Utah later. House Democratic leadership at the federal level, a lot of people seem to have faith that I agree, Pelosi is smart. Pelosi knows what she's doing, but any elected official can be wrong. And I think Democrats are seriously miscalculating not only the situation around the Mueller report and the president and the corruption, but also miscalculating the electorate out there and what they expect of Democrats. And that's something Democrats have a tendency to do. So I'm worried. Obviously, that makes it forefront of my mind anytime I open my yap. This week, I found something different. And that different thing is in the form of, I sat down and so I thought about this. Why does all this bother me so much? We've learned nothing about President Trump since he came into office that we didn't know during the campaign. We have seen this Republican Party for years now. None of it's surprising. Mitch McConnell, least of all. Democrats and their faults and flaws have been the same since, well, in my lifetime. It's always been that way. So as to what it is that gets me good and flared up right now and wanting to say things like, no, this really is the most important election ever coming up in 2020, it really comes down to, well, think about the nature of a choice as an individual. There are some choices that are just, you don't put a lot of thought or internal or external debate into lunch. I know when I go to a place I've been before, I sometimes want to try something new, but I almost always default back to what I know I like. It's not a safety thing. I'm not afraid of the risk. It's a lazy thing. And I think that is something that plays out in our entertainment choices to a large extent. It plays out in our choices of what to drive. It plays out in our voting habits. And it's not wrong. It's a time saver. I do wish that people would feel generally more responsibility with their vote than they do what to have for lunch or what car to drive, because the effects of an election can be much more far ranging. And people like to live their lives. I get it. Not everyone's a political junkie, and not everyone has time to be as plugged in as I unrealistically wish more people were. So I get that. I understand that. But I also understand that there are other choices we make that oftentimes are what psychologists will call a values choice. And that doesn't mean you're making a choice and you're sitting down and you're listing and considering all of your values. It means you think you're doing the same thing as all the other choices. You're doing what feels right. You're going with the gut, right? And you are, really. And that plays out in voting, too. People go with the gut. We don't make as many logical decisions as we like to pretend we do. It's human nature. But when it comes to a, quote, values decision, there is a broader consideration. And oftentimes you'll see a person have stress in their life because of they'll be faced with a decision like this, a values decision. And a values decision, I think you could explain it by saying it's a decision that not only is important and has consequence in your life and your happiness and the meaning in your life, your overall satisfaction with your life. And that makes the decision stand out more than what to have for lunch. But it's also complicated by the fact that subconsciously and sometimes consciously, you realize that this decision is also about who you are. And so sometimes a person will want to make a decision that feels good in the gut, but they don't like what it would say about them and who they are. And so sometimes they freeze there and they can't decide and they get all stressed out and they say things like, I don't know what to do. I'm in a hell of a spot here. And you never see, well, if you did see someone doing that over what to have for lunch, you'd go somewhere else that person wasn't, because who knows where that's going. So I do think that there are more people in the Trump era realizing that, or maybe I just want to think that, but I think there are signs. But that also gets us to what I wanted to talk about this week, because despite the fact that this is, in my opinion, a values election, this election, 2016 was to a large extent, but you can kind of, any country out there gets a few shit the beds, right? America's not above that. We thought we were. Trump got elected. We've now had to accept the fact that we can be as stupid as anything else we've seen on the world stage to date. But doing that twice says something about who we are somewhat permanently. Nothing's permanent. Time passes. Generations come and go. But if Donald Trump is elected a second time, the message sent to the rest of the world and what we have to acknowledge about ourselves as a country is, yeah, we're this racist. We're this awful. We are this afraid of white privileged men losing our power that we're willing to run with this guy. We're all out evangelicals now. That's kind of an important thing to reject. So I'm very, very hopeful that the country does that. And it makes it impossible for me sometimes to think or talk about anything else other than the need to do that, what might help us do that. And I'll be getting back to that on the sidetrack, because there are a lot more aspects of an election and this election specifically that we can explore as sort of under this whole theme of beating Trump. But I realize that there is, outside of the immediate question of impeachment, outside of the recent publication of the Mueller report, outside of the last couple of years of Trump's presidency, outside of all of the political science, all of the analysis, everything the candidates running to beat this orange turd in 2020 have to say, all of that is still happening inside a realm of a somewhat broken system. And that's not insignificant, nor is that a tangential thing during this, the most important election ever. I really hate when people say that, but I'm so close to saying that every time I open my mouth about the election. And it's Trump. It's the effect Trump has on me. It's the effect what Trump's election and what his supporters say about what America is right now and maybe has been for a long time. And naively, we all thought we had progressed a bit more than Trump's existence as president would imply, right? But then you start looking at all the things that aren't different in the Trump era. The media, some of the flaws in both the business side of media and also the get clicks side of media, get eyeballs, get ears, whatever you want to say. Those same flaws are more frequently exploited now, but they're the same flaws. CNN hasn't learned a thing from the 2016 election. There are three candidates I can think of right now that are being propped up entirely by cable news in the Democratic Party's field for 2020. There are many things wrong with that. Most obvious is that is what propelled Trump to the win in 2016 to be the nominee of the Republican Party. Now, that's not the only thing that did. Let's make no mistake. Joe Biden is 100% full of shit when he says Trump is an aberration. He is abhorrent. I agree. But he is not. Trump is 100% something that was bound to come from the Republican Party eventually. I think most of us thought the party. In fact, I was thinking about this the other day. I've said to friends since 2006, this will be the time. This will be the time that the Republicans realize we can't keep doing this. We can't keep being this party. Our ideas are unpopular, and we've been able to prop them up in several ways, some very undemocratic, some just opportunistic, taking advantage of the way the media works, gerrymandering the hell out of the states. And we've been able to prop up our power. And since 2006, every 2 years, I've said to at least one friend, this is the year. This is the year that Republicans realize they cannot, or this is the cycle, rather. That Republicans realize they cannot keep functioning this way. Reagan was their last new idea, and they won big. And then Newt Gingrich came along, and they've been that party since. And Trump was eventually going to happen if they didn't correct course, and they didn't. So Trump isn't a fluke, nor is he a cause. He's a symptom of what's broken in the Republican Party. But there are a lot of things broken in the political system, not just the party or parties. And one of those that I think is, if I had to pick something that is really relevant in general, but more relevant in the Trump era, I think I'd pick corporate lobbying. It's a hard choice. There are a lot of things that are much more relevant in the Trump era. And immigration policy probably stands at the top of that list of things you should be paying attention to right now. Tax policy, a close second. And in general, a long list if you're going to put it in numerical order. But when I say lobbying is the first thing that comes to mind, I say lobbying is the first thing that comes to mind that we could actually do something about by paying more attention in general, and that would also be pretty easy to fix. The rest of these issues are going to be lengthy political debates that the parties cannot stay out of, that elections cannot influence in one way or another, the policy of immigration or the policy of taxation. lobbying is something that can actually be outside of that. Lobbying is also something that could be addressed in the Trump era. It won't be, but it could be. And so for me, that's kind of the first place I go to. And there was actually a personal reason for that to happen this episode, for my brain to go there. There was an event that happened here in my home state. For those listening outside of Utah, there's a great reporter at one of my not favorite, honestly, news outlets in the state, the Deseret News, but an amazing reporter there, Katie McKellar. And let me clarify, I say not favorite, I'm not saying they're bad at what they do, but I don't know, too many Josh Romney stories, too many happy everything's great stories during the legislative session. It bugs me. But that's personal preference. I'm drawn to the Salt Lake Tribune because of how they go about it. Anyway, I digress. Katie McKellar, amazing reporter on the Deseret News, and she is at a board meeting last week. This was a board meeting for something called the Inland Port Authority. For those outside of Utah, this is a really complicated story, so I'm not going to get all of the relevant bits in here. But the quickest way to put it, a former Speaker of the House and a lot of his buddies, a lot of lobbyists, a lot of business interests, and the governor's office. And so basically, wheels are greased like they've never been greased before, to hurriedly create, via legislation, an inland port in Utah in a quadrant of Salt Lake City. What they didn't do is really get the buy-in from the city or the public. And then they were very surprised when this blew up in their face, like it does every time they don't get public buy-in or buy-in from the people most affected by the decision they're making. And this isn't unique to Utah's legislature. This happens all around the country on a somewhat regular basis, blue and red states alike. But it happened. And so then there was this promise. All right, okay, now we'll be transparent. Now we'll slow this down and we'll invite the public in now that you've started bitching. If they would just do that from the start, but they don't. And it ends up a big mess. And so they make some significant concessions, some mere lipstick on a pig, and they move ahead. Since then, the mayor of Salt Lake City has launched a lawsuit against the inland port process itself. We had a hot mic incident where the chair of the Inland Port Board, who also happens to be the president and CEO of the Salt Lake Chamber, statewide chamber of commerce, and used to be the high up with the World Trade Center of Utah, and a guy that I've decided is not good in a leadership position, Derek Miller, now chairing the board, is caught on a hot mic with a Salt Lake County, I believe, council member, or maybe city, I don't remember, and they're having this really juvenile conversation about the mayor, how they could make her go crazy by endorsing one of her opponents in the race. Well, she since said she's not running. It was an embarrassing moment. And of course, nobody involved says, look, I should have been more adult than this. No, they just ignore the public criticism. So there's been this sort of arrogance running through all this, from the entitlement of the Speaker of the House and those around him, that they can just ram this through because it's going to make a lot of people a lot of money, and it has to do with industry and commerce and free markets and blah, blah, blah. I'm not saying an inland port is bad. I know a lot of states are exploring this idea. But that's my point, actually. A lot of states are exploring this idea, and only here in Utah is it a complete and total circus. So why? I started asking that question, and I haven't really been able to answer it outside of saying lawmakers got a bit full of themselves, those involved. They decided to make something happen because they thought it needed to happen, and they didn't consider a better way to go about it, and they didn't consider the fact that they would need, at a certain point, public buy-in, and also at least support of a majority of the city's leadership, because you're going to be taking a lot of land from the city and most likely putting it in the state's coffers when it comes to tax collected. So, I mean, any person not a moron would have said, we've got to get all the players involved here. And so for a few years, it seems like they tried to, and it was moving too slowly for some who felt they were in the position to make this call, and they tried to just pull the trigger quickly. blew up in their face. And they deserved it. But now they're angry because how dare the plebs, right? And this is something that is coming on the backs of watching the legislature here in Utah take the same approach to voter approved ballot initiatives. Two in a row, three in a row, technically. That's coming soon. But you saw them just basically repeal and replace Medicaid expansion ballot initiative approved by voters, medical marijuana ballot initiative approved by voters, and replace it with something that honestly was not as good. When it comes to Medicaid expansion, they did something stupid. Patting themselves on the back and telling the media every time they were asked why they were doing it, oh, voters didn't know what they were signing. And then they basically put together this convoluted and most likely illegal plan that covers less people at a higher cost because they still hate Obama, I guess. It was the most boneheaded thing I've seen a group of mostly old white men do. And that's saying a lot. And here we are. So these things are coming one after another. And the public animosity towards this arrogance from the elected elite is bubbling and building and growing, and it has a tendency to wax and wane in Utah as in any state. But lawmakers always seem completely obtuse about it. They have no clue it's coming. So things just keep happening and happening, and it's almost a predictable game of you know, tip the first domino over and watch the rest play out. So last week at this public meeting, and remember, this is a process been plagued with a lack of transparency. It's a process that has been plagued with a lack of responsibility, a process that's been plagued by hot mic moments by leaders, quote unquote, being really juvenile behind the scenes. It's a process that anyone expecting the public to have full confidence in this process right now is an idiot. And there's no recognition of how justified the public would be in not having confidence in this process. And yet, they trudge ahead. Last week, at this meeting, protesters show up. Second meeting in a row. Meeting a month ago was completely canceled due to protesters that just came in and wouldn't shut up. Last week, protesters showed up at this month's meeting, and I'm guessing their intent was to do the same, but the board was prepared this time, and like many protests, the highway patrol was there, and they dragged the protesters out. It's all part of sort of the kabuki theater of protesting, and it works. It gets headlines. It gets attention, and it definitely has a lot more people plugged in, even if they don't live in Salt Lake City, to the Inland Port process and the debate around it. So, thumbs up to protesters. As the protesters are being dragged out, Deseret News reporter Katie McKellar tries to do what a journalist would do. She attempts to interact with the protesters. I can only speculate as to what she would ask, but I would assume because she didn't get a chance. We're getting to that. I can only assume that, you know, why were you here? What were you protesting? The things a journalist would do and should do when this process is playing out in front of them. As she's moving towards the door, and there's video. Oh, is there video? Her own video that was captured somehow by, it looks like, two different people, and then given to McKellar and the Deseret News by the ACLU of Utah. I'm not familiar with how that video surfaced, but so there's three different angles you can actually watch this event play out from. The Salt Lake Tribune and the Deseret News have both linked to the video in multiple stories, including a scathing editorial from the Salt Lake Tribune defending McKellar and the Deseret News and the First Amendment against what happened. So what happened is, as McKellar's moving towards the door, an oil and gas lobbyist, a man named Jeff Hartley, who also happens to be, by the way, the brother of Greg Hartley, who is was in the staff side of the Utah House, but has since left that position to run the, well, this will be announced soon, trust me, but right now it's just what we know and hasn't been confirmed, but to run the gubernatorial campaign of Greg Hughes, the guy who kind of helped to start all of this mess by trying to ram it through. a couple of years ago in the legislative process. So his top staffer's brother is an oil and gas lobbyist, and he steps into the doorway of a public meeting, by the way, again, reminding you that, public meeting, steps into the doorway to block the path of McKellar. As Katie McKellar of the Deseret News is moving out to talk to the protesters, he steps into the doorway to block her path. And then he says things along the lines of, I don't know why you cover these guys. You're just going to make more of it. Stop paying attention to them. Now, understandably, there are a lot of things to be upset here about. I've seen a lot of people wondering, legitimate question, too, whether Hartley would have done this had the journalist been a man. I think that's a legit question. I have seen a lot of people, myself included, demanding that people in leadership roles, including the governor of the state, weigh in and condemn this behavior. Because otherwise, I don't think this Inland Port Board has any credibility with the public. If they care about that, they need to condemn this behavior. So far, it's been crickets and silence, because that's what entitled people do. It'll go away because these annoying birds are just complaining. Hartley, though, made me, his behavior made me think of something else. Which was a book I read recently. And that's when everything kind of fell into place. Because I'm watching this video play out. I'm watching this oil and gas lobbyist, state level only. I mean, this is a guy in the world of lobbying. This guy is pretty much the lowest you can get on the lobbying totem pole. Now, not because it's oil and gas, but because he's just a state lobbyist. Lobbying is huge business, and in D.C. is where the real players go. But here he is at this public meeting, and he obviously thinks he's in some sort of position of authority. He obviously thinks he is in some sort of position to influence news coverage by instructing this journalist to stop covering the event because, quote, it'll just happen again if you guys pay attention to them. And he obviously feels that he's in enough of a position of authority that he can step into a damn doorway and block a journalist. The Salt Lake Tribune in an editorial called it a crystallizing moment. And I 100% agree on a couple of different fronts, though. It's a crystallizing moment here locally in Utah of the arrogance of everyone so far behind this inland port. And everyone in a leadership role right now on the board itself, the Inland Port Authority board. But it's also a crystallizing moment of not just the influence of lobbying, but what would lead a lobbyist working for any industry to feel like they were in a position of power? Well, what makes a person feel like they're in a position of power? Being in a position of power, being a decision maker, being an influencer, being someone who gets to help call a lot of shots, you start to feel a bit important. We've all had this experience either through our jobs, through political activism, whatever it might be. And something's obviously making this Hartley guy, he wasn't a guy that was just there to do his job, which is all a lobbyist is. A lobbyist is just someone paid by a corporation or a conglomerate of corporations, an industry-backed spokesperson who's there to be a part of the conversation, to be the voice of whatever industry they're representing. That's it. I mean, this is a high-priced messenger, and that's all lobbyists really are. And yet he feels like this process is his. In this video. So I got thinking about this. I got thinking about something that even here in the Trump era is the same and hasn't really changed in the Trump era. and something that should change, because I think it's a big part of what got us to the Trump era. I think it's something that is being used by a lot of politicians while we're all staring at our phones and screens with mouth agape at the latest batshit insane thing the rotten tangerine president just did or said. They're running off over here into the corner to get things done. That's why Republicans, if you really want the real reason Republicans aren't that concerned or upset about Trump and the absolute embarrassment they're going to spend years running away from, is because they're getting a lot done right now. He's a great distraction. But this isn't specific to the Trump era. Our political institutions have been experiencing an internal rot for decades. It's most evident in the Republican Party when they're in power. But it's developed. You see this play out in this short-term, short-sighted game of one-upmanship that leads to a lot of concerned pundits to clutch their pearls and say, oh, I don't know if they can govern. It's so polarized. But never do the same partisans dig deeper into that. It's always because of the immediate. Remember when Obama needed to compromise? I mean, think about this. You have pundits, the same ones every time, who every 2 years, you see this process. 2008, Obama's great. He's post-partisan. He's going to fix all this, and there'll be, you know, it'll just be less black and angry out there for us white people. 2 years later, the Republican or the pundits are all, oh, Obama needs to compromise. He's trying to change too much. He needs to compromise. 2012, oh, this guy, you know, he really needs to speak to both sides of the country. He's too far left. He wins again. Okay, great, great. We're post-partisan again. 2014, oh, Obama needs to compromise. But you notice this pattern. This pattern that develops where you don't hear these same pundits talking about what's happening within the Republican Party. You don't have a single pundit out there that was saying Obama needed to compromise in 2011, 12, 13, 14, 15, who is now saying, holy shit, are you watching Mitch McConnell? This might seem unrelated to lobbying. It's not. It really isn't. There's a brokenness. The media and the role they play. And when I say the media, I'm mostly talking about the national voices, the way things are reported, the punditocracy at the national level. They're incapable of approaching the Republican Party the same way. And I think it's really a simple explanation. They're incapable because they're so afraid of the right wing noise machine, as Hillary Clinton called it in the mid 90s. They're so afraid of that. They're so afraid of the accusations of bias that they subconsciously tip the scales in the opposite direction and hold the Democrats to a higher standard again and again and again than they do Republicans. Meanwhile, inside what is supposed to be a war of ideas, a policy tug of war at the federal government level, it's a free-for-all. And I don't mean a free-for-all like, you know, everyone at fisticuffs. I mean a free-for-all like the lobbyists are, hey, well, they're over there watching the president's latest racist rant at his rally in Texas. Can we tuck this into this piece of legislation? Yeah, sure. And unfortunately, Democrats, though less brazen about this than Republicans, are in no position to actually stand as a strong pushback against this. But let's pause for a second. So I'm blaming a lot of how we got here on the political institutions, but I'm saying that the cancer, the rot that was the lobbying takeover, America's lobbying addiction, as political scientist Lee Drutman calls it, has been building for a long time, and it's hollowed out the policymaking process to an extent that you start to see, you know, these privileged think pieces. Do the parties matter anymore? I mean, really, we are not at a point where we can start speculating in such an academic way. Because the parties do matter enough right now that when they're in power, they are calling the shots. But who's calling the shots for the parties? How did we get here? I mentioned Lee Drutman, and I highly recommend you check out a book of his published in 2015, but still entirely relevant today, that I swear will make you think entirely differently about the Trump era and how we got here. It's called The Business of America is Lobbying. And he's basically talking about the American political system, the history of lobbying, and where it's at. And then he wraps up with where he thinks we should go from here. It's an amazing read, really. He makes a strong argument that the rise of lobbying is the key story of American political failure, the polarization of today, Trump, the Republican Party producing Trump as their first big realignment since Reagan. They're now the party of Donald Trump. How did we get there? And Drutman, even though he's writing this in 2015, inadvertently makes a case that lobbying, hollowing out the political system to the extent that it has, got us here. Everything that's currently wrong with the American political system, you can tie back to this glut and dependency on lobbying. And Drutman talks about a lot of different reasons for this. And he's really careful in the book to point out something I also believe, that lobbying in and of itself isn't bad. It's not evil in and of itself. It's our dependency on it, especially at the federal level. So, quickly, Drutman's history. He lays out this history. He talks about this, quote, watershed moment in 1970. And you have this business world out there that just sort of found themselves, ironically, and impossible to imagine in the political era most of us know today. In the 1970s, you had these large corporations that were, you know, not getting a call back from elected officials at the federal level. So then they would try the state level and they wouldn't get a call back there. They were being ignored. They were being marginalized by the political system of the 60s and the momentum and the movements of the 60s. Basically, this social awareness that was leading to a marginalization of corporate interests. It's hard to have sympathy, right? But that's what was happening. And so there was a reaction to that. And it built up some quick momentum because there was a lot of money to be thrown at this. Corporations started banding together and putting their minds and money together to lobby and to influence political debates, to influence regulatory debates at the state and federal level. And they were extremely successful at it. And as Drutman details, over the next four decades, from the early 70s on, they took over. They were better at this than anything. And here's where Drutman makes a point, though, after detailing in great detail a very interesting history, 81 to 2004, roughly, he looks at lobbying expenditures to show their growth and the growth of lobbying, corporate lobbying as an industry. It's mind-blowing. And it's amazing that at the state level, any citizen organization, citizen lobbyist, nonprofit, anyone that's not a corporation, it's almost impossible to believe they're getting the same influence or number of ears from their state lawmakers, and they're absolutely not getting that from their federal delegates. So Drutman says lobbying isn't evil. What has become a problem is that lobbying became an industry and it took over the political systems. And unfortunately, what happened is something you see happen all the time. And I think we have a problem with this in the consultant world, too, when it comes to political consultants. But it becomes a self-perpetuating design. Because not only are these high-paid lobbyists going out there and convincing lawmakers they're important by helping lawmakers flush out a bill or fill in some blanks on a difficult and thorny issue they're trying to solve at the state level, at the federal level, lobbyists are also turning around to the businesses that hire them and saying, look what I did for you. How can you afford to not pay me to do this? So corporations obviously are going to be self-serving. Then you have lobbyists who are ultimately self-serving. And then you have lawmakers who, even if it's a lawmaker with the best of intentions trying to get something done, are going to be at some point dependent on the self-serving lobbyists serving the self-serving corporation. And they become, let's say, so dependent on that, that those are the only voices they're hearing. Not only does it get very hard for citizen organizations or movements to get their foot in that door that the lobbyists are leaning their fat asses up against to keep closed, but you also have this, as Drutman calls it, this self-perpetuating cycle. Lawmakers dependent on the lobbyists, especially at the state level. Lobbyists dependent on the lawmakers to hear them, but also dependent on the corporations to buy them. But if somehow convinced everyone involved, the corporations that are buying and paying for lobbyists and the lawmakers who are listening to lobbyists are both convinced they can't function without the lobbyists. It's genius, really. And I thought about this as I'm watching this video of this lobbyist stepping in front of a journalist here in the state of Utah last week and asking myself, what would make a person think they were in that position? What would make a person think that it was their place to control a narrative around a public board by making the very unethical move of stepping in to block a journalist's path so they can't film or interview an individual who is protesting the board? What would make a person feel like that was an appropriate thing for them to do? Well, of course, there's hubris. I can't think of anything else that would make a person feel like they should step in a journalist's path. But more buried below that, I doubt this person showed up to this meeting feeling like just another lobbyist, and then throughout the meeting suddenly became a person who thinks, I'm in a position of authority and I'm shutting this down. No, this is a person who has thought that for a while. What would make them think that? I mean, this is a self-answering question. So I picked up Drutman's book and I reread it. And I remembered a couple of things he does at the end that at the time when I read this book, this would have been late 2015, I didn't think really was, it was interesting, something to keep in the back of my mind. It wasn't a pressing issue at the time in my mind, but now it seems maybe like addressing the absolute takeover of American politics that corporate lobbying is and has become, and is still today, it seems more important. Trump makes me think that's more important. More specifically, Republicans doing what they're doing while Trump does what he does, and Democrats not really pushing back on this, and fair enough, not really in a position to push back yet, with just the House. I mean, they're pushing back as much as they can on that legislative side of things in the House. But when Democrats, if they were to take the Senate and maintain the House, I don't think they push back hard enough then even. It's very concerning. Drutman, in his book, presents three different categories of solutions, and he spends a lot of time on these. And the first is, I think, the most unrealistic as far as something I can see actually happening in America. But he talks about maybe developing something that you might call the Office of Public Lobbying, sort of like public defenders, but their job is to serve as a liaison for citizens, groups of citizens, neighborhoods, communities, underserved and underprivileged communities and individuals. And their job would be to go lobby state lawmakers the same way this arrogant journalist blocking oil and gas lobbyist does here in Utah, this Hartley guy. I like the idea. I just think that's the most unrealistic as far as something that would actually happen. Spending taxpayer dollars like we do with public defenders to give citizens a voice. Can you imagine the right wing hysteria that would develop? Anyway, the second and third group of solutions, though, I think are actually doable. Drutman in the book labels them genuine public conversation reforms. And something to know about Drutman is that he actually comes from a world I'm very familiar with, which is the government transparency and the open data world. He started a long time ago in this world and has worked with several organizations I've had a chance to work with since. And it's a name that, I mean, I've known the name Lee Drutman for decades. 15 years. And he has been very consistent on this. And so in his second set of proposed solutions, you can really see that experience coming out because he talks about he talks about a procedure that could be developed to kind of air out and bring some transparency to the lobbying process itself, to loosen the level of influence that a well-moneyed lobbyist might have over a political system or process, like this Hartley guy here in Utah has probably enjoyed throughout his career as an oil and gas lobbyist. Some sort of transparency would make that at least more of a challenge. And that, I think, would actually be hard to argue against should some actual energy develop around building that level of transparency at the state level, in every state. And then finally, in his book, he talks about at the state and federal level, building up an ability to research and process problem solving and sausage grinding without a dependency on lobbyists. And this is something that I actually remember talking about at a few years ago at a Sunlight Foundation event in Washington, D.C. There was a woman who was involved with the military and had also worked with Congress quite a bit. And you can follow her on Twitter. Laura Lee Riley is her name. And she talked a lot about the importance of a staff, of educated, well-trained staff, and also the problem with the cuts made on that front when it comes to Congress's budget. The tendency for turnover increasing after salaries were considered secondary when it came to staff as a congressional consideration. And I remember her talking about that, saying, that one of the problems with the invasion of Iraq and the way that the strategy in Iraq was planned and carried out had a lot to do with Congress not really having any institutional knowledge to fall back on, and yet refusing to let people outside of their cozy lobbyist circles come in and educate them on it. So the staff wasn't there to help them. They weren't smart enough themselves, and they didn't want outsiders coming in, so they just turned to the lobbyists. They turned to arms manufacturers. They turned to government contractors. They basically turned to all the people that could make a lot of money off of a war and said, what do you think we should do? And that is the standard, not the exception. Not just when it comes to a strategy of war inside a White House with occasionally Congress getting to check in. This is everything from health care. We saw this play out a bit with Democrats, a handful of Democrats during the Obamacare debate. We saw this play out when Bush Jr. attempted to do something not insane with immigration and the lobbyists came screaming, not because They were representing a business that would suffer if immigration policy got sane in this country. If we raised a few caps and increased the number of a few visas, they weren't opposed to that. What they were opposed to is that they weren't consulted, because some of these companies had contracts to make a lot of money off of E-Verify and other things like that, and nobody even called them. Yeah, that really happened. So Drutman talks about this, what he calls a congressional clerkship program for law students. And it could be others, but he uses law students as an example. But he talks about developing a group of experienced, talented people and putting them in a position where they can serve as sort of a resource for lawmakers at the state and federal level to make policy. So they're not so dependent on local and national think tanks, which always have a donor-driven agenda. So they're not so dependent on straight-up registered lobbyists like this Hartley guy here in Utah, who I'm sure many lawmakers in my home state believe has helped them in more ways than he's benefited himself, which cannot possibly be the reality. Drutman proposes breaking this dependency of elected policymakers in America as a necessary thing to address many of the problems we see today, from polarization to the election of Donald Trump to the absolute lack of responsiveness of the Republican Party when it comes to the literal fact that many of their policy proposals are publicly unpopular, but they can't seem to move anywhere else anyway. He points at a lot of this. Democrats and their milquetoast, mealy-mouthed opposition to some of the things the Republicans have done in certain cases, because lobbying and corporate money is involved, and they don't want to lose it either. Drutman says, until we deal with this, Drutman's careful, again, to point out again and again that this was an unintended hijacking of the political system. He doesn't want to paint corporations as evil. He doesn't even want to paint corporate lobbyists as evil, and I don't think we should either. But what is evil is the fact that the entire system is built around them now. And so this incident I'm using here in Utah might be one little tiny example of one lobbyist making a really dumb decision to step in front of a journalist and stop her from filming protesters. That's bad enough in and of itself, but I think it's indicative of a larger problem. A much larger problem in America that has led to a political system that could open the doors for something like a President Trump, but long before a President Trump, was also hollowing out consumer protections, was also tipping the tax scales to such an extent that most Americans don't even believe anymore things could be different for them. Lobbying has taken over so much that it's directly contributing to the lack of interest people have in being citizen lobbyists, in getting involved long term in a legislative process or a legislative issue. It's a great book. Drutman's a smart guy. And his solutions, I don't know, they couldn't be the only ones. I'm not even, and he's not even saying they're the best ones. But this is something for us to think about, I think, right now. This is something that if you're looking to get away from the jaw-dropping news cycle that revolves around this Republican Party and this president, and that, believe me, is only going to stick around, if not ratchet up, as we move closer to 2020's real election cycle kicking off. Think about this. Work towards this. Maybe that's something that activists and organizations could collectively point themselves towards. Make it less of a vague criticism of the corporatism that has invaded our policymaking circles, and more of a specific citizen lobbying effort to tweak the rules a bit and undo some of the absolute, as Drutman calls it, dependency and addiction that lawmakers, both at the federal and state levels around the country, currently feel. Because, simply put, corporate lobbyists were more successful than they even tended to be. That's it for me this week. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week, and I don't know, I'll probably get back to the impeachment thing. We'll see. Exciting times.